It's the Law is Cool podcast, episode 18. Hello and welcome to the show. So, a few weeks ago, I'm in my family law class at the University of Manitoba, and my professor made a comment in passing about the possibility of Canadian law recognizing polygamy as a valid form of marriage, and it was neither here nor there in the lecture, and she moved on to a different topic without giving it too much thought. But 1 week after that happened, two men were arrested in British Columbia and charged with one count each of polygamy under Section 293 of the Criminal Code. So one of the accused, Winston Blackmore, says that he plans to challenge the criminal prohibition of polygamy under the Charter. He claims that the criminalization of polygamy violates freedom of conscience and religion as guaranteed in the Charter. So this has sparked a debate about what sort of public policy response that we should have to the practice. Should polygamy continue to be an indictable offense? Should our definition of marriage be changed to incorporate polygamy? Should spouses of polygamy relationships have property rights under family law? So on today's show, I'm going to speak with two law professors who have very different perspectives on the legal response to polygamy. Dr. Margaret Somerville is a leading bioethicist who was vocally opposed to the redefinition of marriage to include same-sex marriage. Now, she argues that this has opened the door to all sorts of further changes to marriage, including the recognition of polygamy, and she's opposed to these sorts of changes. But first, I'm going to speak with Queen's Law Professor Beverly Baines, who believes that a charter challenge might be a serious threat to the criminal offense of polygamy. All right, I am on the line with Professor Beverly Baines in Kingston, Ontario. Professor Baines is a professor of law at the Queen's University Faculty of Law, and she's also the head of the Department of Women's Studies. Professor Baines, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So, to set the stage, Section 293 of the Criminal Code of Canada essentially criminalizes plural unions and polygamy in Canada. It's an indictable offense, so those participating in that sort of a union could potentially face a prison term of up to 5 years. Now, a while back, you co-authored one of a series of papers funded by Status of Women Canada, looking at various dimensions of the criminalization of polygamy in Canada. And one of the arguments that was raised is that the criminal prohibition might attract scrutiny under the Charter. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay, I didn't invent that argument. Of course, Winston Blackmore himself raised it, and I would hate to make any suggestion that I'm working for him. I'm not. The notion that he would challenge the section that prohibits polygamy, that criminalizes polygamy, is based on the claim that virtually all polygamy that's practiced around the world today arises out of religious motivations. It doesn't mean that it's a religion that you or I or your listeners might share, but it certainly appears that virtually all polygamy is religiously justified. If you've been watching the television show Big Love, I think you understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so Winston Blackmore would claim, or whoever's charged, but he's the one who's been charged, would claim that the polygamy provision violates his freedom of religion under the Charter. He might also try to claim that it violates his Section 7 rights under the Charter and his Section 15 rights under the Charter, although in the article that you referred to, we didn't develop those arguments, and I'd just as soon not get into them at this point, just to stick with how the claim with respect to freedom of religion would go. As you know, from the decisions, and I would only talk about Supreme Court of Canada decisions, as you know, the Supreme Court of Canada has very liberally interpreted what religion means and what freedom of religion encompasses, probably rightly so, because the court does not want to get in a position of deciding what's religious dogma and what isn't. So the court simply takes the position that if it's a sincerely held belief, the court is going to treat it as a freedom of religion issue. It would look at the polygamy provision and say, yes, those people believe they're practicing polygamy because they will have a better afterlife. This is a violation of their entitlement to freedom of religion, and move the argument to Section 1 of the Charter.
Right. So assuming if such an argument was presented in court and the court accepted that this was a prima facie breach of the Charter, of course, the next step would be to go into sort of an Oakes analysis on the justification of that breach. So the first stage in that, of course, is that the government would have to identify some sort of purpose or goal for the law that would be of sufficient importance to justify a charter infringement. So, I mean, when I think about polygamy, at least as it's practiced in Canada, and I think a lot of people think of it this way, we think about fairly significant disparities in power between men and women. We think about the possibility of this being harmful to children. So is that the government's purpose with the criminal code provision? And if so, could that possibly be a sufficiently weighty reason?
Well, you ask a good question. Clearly, the government would claim that harm to women and children is the reason for prohibiting polygamy. I mean, the interesting question, of course, is why there haven't been any prosecutions for 60 years. One might question whether that harm just hasn't existed, or they haven't imagined it, or whatever. However, there are two problems with that harm to women and children argument. One is that there is no evidence that they can put forward conclusively of harm to women and children. The first article, there were a collection of four articles, and our article was among those four, but the first article was by Professor Angela Campbell at the University of McGill. It's entitled, How Have Policy Approaches to Polygamy Responded to Women's Experiences and Rights? An International Comparative Analysis. And Professor Campbell looks at all of the international research studies on polygamy, and when she started her research, she says in her article, she expected them to say conclusively that women are socially, economically, and in terms of well-being and health, harmed by polygamy. At the end of her analysis of all those international research studies, she came to the conclusion that there was no conclusive evidence. That's of harm to women and children. That is then complicated by the fact that with polygamy being a criminal offense in Canada, we can't do scientific authoritative studies of its harm to women and children in Canada until it's decriminalized. In fact, one of her arguments and mine for decriminalization is so we can find out if women and children are harmed. But that's the first problem the government would have, and indeed it's why Wally Opal took so long to lay the charges in Bountiful, because he kept getting advised by the three different investigators that he set up that he wasn't going to be able to get the evidence of harm. And of course, if he's going to claim harm as his Section 1 defense, he's going to have to give evidence of harm. I don't think he can. Clearly, there have been reports out there, Daphne Brahman's report, and the reports, one of the studies of women who had left Bountiful, but those are not scientific studies. They are anecdotal reports. I wouldn't discredit them for a minute. They are real, and they are about women and children who feel they've been harmed. But they're not the kind of evidence that's going to be sufficient to sustain the government's claim under Section 1 that the purpose of this legislation is to prevent harm to women and children, and see, there are the studies on which we base our claim. They can't do it. They don't have the studies. It wouldn't work that way. But the second problem that the government faces, in the first prong of the Oakes test, i.e., what is the purpose of Section 293, in 1892, when it was first included in our first criminal code, it explicitly said that the purpose was to keep Mormons and ex-Mormons out of Canada. So the purpose was not to promote the equality rights of women and children, which is what you were talking about in the power dimension, but rather the purpose was a religious purpose. And if we go back to the freedom of religion cases, we know the Supreme Court of Canada has concluded that you can't use one person's religious freedom against another's under the reasonable limits clause of Section 1. So if the government says, but no, times have changed, we took that clause out and it's really to protect women and children, they're facing a problem with shifting interests. We know that the court has said you can't have shifting purposes. So they're still stuck with that 1892 purpose of Section 293, and they're not likely to be able to survive the first prong. But in our analysis, we say, well, okay, let's assume, for the sake of argument, hey, we're law profs, let's assume that the government is able to make the hypothetical argument stick about harm to women and children. Then we have to go forward and do the assessment under the proportionality test.
That's right.
Shall I assume you'd like to do the proportionality test?
Well, let's keep on going. Let's see what would happen.
Yeah, well, you know what the first prong of the proportionality test is.
So the first prong of the proportionality test is, assuming we've identified this purpose, is it rationally connected to the measures that have been adopted to address that harm?
And to use your earlier statement that we're concerned about the power dimension as we try to assess the rational connection. In other words, we're concerned about the subordination of women in polygamous relationships. The difficulty with that, attempting to connect the prohibition on polygamy, the measure, with the purpose, preventing subordination, is that it's both over and under inclusive. You know what's coming next. Monogamous relationships have serious power dimension problems. So if you just prohibit polygamy, you're not doing very much for women and children who are in subordinate marital relationships. And so we made the argument that the government was not going to be able to survive the rational connection test, that there was no rational connection between prohibiting polygamy and the purpose, which is to promote women's equality, to prevent women's subordination, to not encourage that power relationship that you talked about.
Right. So
the next prong is
minimal impairment.
Minimal impairment.
Are the measures that are chosen by the state minimally impairing of the right?
And what do you think I'm going to say about that one? If you think about the minimal impairment test, is it minimally impairing the rights of the parties involved? And remember, Section 293, and I'll just go back and read it out explicitly, starts everyone. So women can be prosecuted under this provision as well. And I've talked to another constitutional lawyer who said, oh, well, they would never prosecute women. Well, excuse me. Are we talking about sex discrimination here? Are we talking about a Section 15 challenge? Of course, if they're going to say that there's a harm out there, they have to think about who they are prosecuting. And one of the problems is that the penalty, as you said earlier, is incarceration. It's a maximum of 5 years incarceration. Is that minimal impairment when you realize that, let's assume they prosecute the man in the relationship? Who's going to be responsible for the welfare of the women and children while he is serving his 5 years in an institution? Is it minimally impairing? I don't think so. I think that if Canada doesn't want to subscribe to polygamy, all we need to do is say we won't legalize it. We do not need to criminalize it and, in effect, make criminals of the women and the children as well in these relationships.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to be seen to be minimally impairing. And, of course, the last prong of the proportionality test is to measure the deleterious effects against the salutary effects. Courts don't seem to pay a lot of attention to that. But I think if we were to address the question and ask whether or not putting women in a position where they may also be prosecuted for the crime of polygamy is not exactly salutary when we're trying to improve their relationship.
Right. So without trying to predict what the courts will say in any ongoing cases...
Oh, I'm totally happy
if,
to do that.
If the courts were to strike down Section 293 of the Criminal Code, what's next? Is this the first step toward the recognition under our domestic law of polygamy, or where do we go from here?
Two ways to go, and they're not mutually exclusive. We argued that if the crime of polygamy was struck down, then it would address the anomalous position, in fact, the very difficult position that's faced by immigrants to Canada from regimes where polygamy is a validly recognized form of marriage. As you know, a significant number of countries in the world subscribe to polygamy as a valid form of marriage. And I always tell the story that if two separate immigrant families come to Canada's border, and the first one, they're both from the same country, a country that recognizes polygamy as a valid form of marriage, but the first couple is just a husband and a wife, for example, to use the heterosexual example that you might use. And they come to the border and they say, yes, well, we come from a country that validates polygamous marriage, but we actually are living monogamously. The Canadian border officials will say, we'll deem your potentially polygamous marriage as actually monogamous and let you in. Your neighbor on the same street, in the same city, in the same country, who is living in an actually polygamous relationship comes to our border right now and gets told, go away, if we let you in, you're a criminal. If we decriminalize, we stop treating those immigrants differentially. And we let them in for very, you know, for other reasons in our immigration policy, but we don't preclude them from entering because they're practicing polygamy. But that doesn't mean that everybody in Canada has to be allowed to practice polygamy. So if you then ask the question, all right, well, what happens next? Other than that, we at least make our immigration rules fairer to people coming from countries where polygamy is recognized as valid. What happens? What will Winston Blackmore do? What will happen? You know, what about Bountiful? What will they try to do? Winston Blackmore, I think, has already been quoted in newspapers over the years saying he would challenge the law that says that a marriage has to be between two persons. Now, we all know that that law was passed 3 or 4 years ago in the Marriage Act. It says a marriage is defined as a union of two persons, and he would challenge that. Again, he would use religious freedom. Again, he'd probably get the right. They'd say the right has been infringed. Again, Section 1 gets invoked. Now the government might be in a very much stronger position to say, but our purpose 3 years ago was to protect the equality rights of women and to ensure that there isn't harm to children. Because that was in vogue 3 years ago. It wasn't in 1892 or even in 1994 when the provision was changed. I think there would be much more likelihood, although somebody's going to have to do a lot of research about the rationale behind the Marriage Act being defined in terms of two persons. That's research that would relate to something that took place 2 or 3 years ago. And under those circumstances, perhaps I think the Supreme Court of Canada would say, that's fine, we're prepared to decriminalize, but we're not prepared to legalize. We think the government has found a reasonable limit, and that reasonable limit is not to legalize polygamous marriages. And, of course, we all know the distinction between decriminalizing and legalizing in the context of marijuana, so we can understand it in the context of polygamy.
I think a certain segment of our viewers will be familiar with that distinction. Excellent. Well, I think those are all of the questions that I had for you, but unless there's anything else that you wanted to add or any additional comments that you have about the topic?
Well, there are a couple. I think that the vast majority of people do not approve of polygamy, and I think that they are not very familiar with it. I'm certainly not familiar with it. I'm not saying I approve of it. I'm saying, in policy terms, making criminals out of the people who practice it achieves nothing. deciding not to legalize it is perfectly consistent with our policy if we want to be a monogamous country. However, I think we need to think about the fact that with immigration in recent years, we have significantly changed from the old British Empire and French regime that we were, which subscribed mainly to Christianity, to a country that as much as one-third of our population subscribes to religions that may, and I'm thinking of the Islamic religion, for example, but that's not the only one, may subscribe to polygamy. And I think we have to take significant account of those cultural changes in Canada and who we are, who we have become, who we were not back in 1892 or 1954 when we were talking about polygamy, but who we are today. And I think it's time to play catch-up with the cultures that exist in Canada. If we decriminalize, we can research whether or not polygamy harms women and children. But, you know, I'm old enough to go back to the hippies in the 60s and the 70s and say, what about those communes? We laughed about them. We didn't say that they were sinful. We looked at them and treated them very differently. And somewhere along the line, I think we have to take a serious look at what polygamy involves and whether it really is a constitutionally harmful relationship. I, for one, don't know the answer to that and would not pretend to.
That was Beverly Baines of Queen's University. Well, the polygamy debate has also prompted comment from a very different perspective. My next guest is an opponent of same-sex marriage. She argues that the recognition of same-sex marriage in Canada could lead to further changes, including the recognition of polygamy. So joining me on the line from Montreal is Dr. Margaret Somerville, one of Canada's leading bioethicists. She is the Samuel Gale Professor of Law at McGill University, as well as the founding director of the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law. Dr. Somerville, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
It's my pleasure.
So let's go back to the great national debate that we had a few years ago, and that in some ways is still going on around same-sex marriage. You were opposed to the legal recognition of same-sex marriage, though for different reasons than a lot of the opponents of that bill were. Could you tell me a little bit about your views about the role of marriage in a society, and why you were opposed to that policy change?
Yes, well, marriage is, it's to do with adults, of course, you know, it's adults who get married, but it's also, I think even more importantly, to do with children. And the institution of marriage sets up what we as a society see are the needed protections of children, what is best for them. And these days we'd also probably talk in terms of what rights should children have. It's an, you know, that's a new thought to think about children's rights, because up until relatively recently they were regarded in the law particularly as having no rights, that they were rights belong to adults. And we've become much more aware that we need to think of some kinds of rights for children. And the why I was opposed to same-sex marriage is because marriage itself, the institution, has got two parts to it. What marriage does is it gives people the definition was it gave a man and a woman the right to marry, and then the next right was and the right to found a family. And so out of that man and woman's right to marry came the right to found a family. And what that meant was that that gave children the right to a mother and a father. The definition of parent that was used was the parent is the natural parent of the child. In other words, it was based in biology, and so therefore a child had a primary right to be brought up within its own, with its own genetically related parents, its own mother and father, and with that, all the other people that are genetically related to you are the wider family, brothers and sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, grandparents, etc. And I think that's very important, and in fact there's now research going on to look at what role genetic identity plays in our sort of becoming the person that we are, and it's pretty important. And so a lot of my work over the last 6 to 12 months has been arguing that the most fundamental human right of all is the right to come into existence from natural human origins, and that's one sperm from an identified living adult man, and all of those adjectives in there have got a reason, and one ovum from an identified living adult woman. So that's sort of, you know, that's within the context of same-sex marriage, why I have a problem with it. But as well, if you look at what happened in same-sex marriage, the argument that marriage is a or family formation, which is what marriage is about, is simply a matter of personal preference, which is really what the gay community who supported this said, that we want to found families. Our personal preference is to have what they call a genderless family. We don't want a man and a woman. And therefore, we've got the right to do this, and to prohibit us from doing this is unconstitutional because it's discrimination within Section 15 of the Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms of our Canadian Constitution. And the courts upheld that. So once you disconnect marriage from that primary biological reality of one man and one woman can naturally create a child, and you say, well, it's up to you to define what you think marriage should be, then why can't you extend it to say, well, instead of being two people, it could be a group of people? And the other thing that this raises is that if polygamy is allowed, and if it's wrong to allow certain forms of institution, in this case marriage, for opposite sex people, then do we have to allow it for same-sex people? So could you have what's called polyamory, that, for instance, five men or five women or three men and two women or whatever you personally prefer as your family structure, should that be allowed? So that's the sort of fix we've got into.
Right. So as I understand your argument, you're saying in part that by changing our laws around same-sex marriage, essentially we've changed the nature of what marriage is in our society, and we've made it something that's to do with preference, personal preference, rather than about biology.
Yeah.
So as we both know, there is a criminal case going on in British Columbia right now, and it's expected that the defendant in that case is going to raise a charter argument, essentially saying that the criminal prohibition against polygamy is a violation of freedom of religion under the charter. And as I understand it, you believe that in order to be consistent, at least with the jurisprudence around same-sex marriage, the prospects of success for that argument are actually fairly high.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, you never know what the courts are going to do. You never know how they will apply Section 1 of the Charter, which is the saving provision, which says even though what you're doing is contrary to a charter right, for instance, prohibiting polygamy, in the interests of society, we will still allow you to prohibit it. So there is an opt-out clause. But, what I'm saying is that if you take the reasoning that was used in the same-sex marriage and you say that we've moved away from making marriage is the cultural institution that surrounds the one-on-one man-woman biological reality of producing a child. So you take it away from that and you say, no, we're going to include some other people in this where that's not the biological reality, then you can extend it to other kinds of unions. And so one of the question here is it wrong to prohibit these people whose preference and the kind of union they want as marriage is one man and lots of women. And they say, well, that's what we choose. That's our personal preference. It also happens to be our religious beliefs. And you're wrongfully interfering with these.
So you touched on Section 1 of the Charter and the fact that, of course, charter rights, if they're found, can still be interfered with if it's justifiable. And there's, of course, the Oaks test and all of that jurisprudence around that. Do you think that there is a harm in allowing polygamy within Canadian society? And what's sort of the nature of that harm?
I think we have to look at, you know, various aspects. With a lot of things, there's harm and there's also, I mean, if you want to uphold the idea that it's good for society to allow people to, within limits, to do what they want to do, to organize themselves as they want to be organized, and therefore we've got to have good reasons for restricting their choices. Then you look to, well, what's the wrongs of this and what's the harm? I'm not an expert on polygamy or, you know, what the practical realities are. What I read, and it's the same thing as other Canadians are reading at the moment, I'm sure, is that it's not good for women. Certainly the women's groups seem to think that that's the case. Although it's strange, because even though these women choose to do that and argue that's what they want to do, then the argument comes back, yes, but they're brainwashed, that's what they've been brought up to think they should do. So, you know, that's a sort of interesting argument, that you're not respecting their choice, even though they say that's what they want. Actually, I think if it was, again, I would use the same approach that I used to same-sex marriage. You know what, I've got no objection to same-sex marriage if it was just the adults involved. That's why I support civil unions, because that doesn't affect children. Civil unions give adults rights but don't affect children's rights. So if I was looking at polygamy, the big focus I would have is on what harm does that do to these children? And, you know, people tell us that it's not good for children. And, you know, I can't comment whether what the evidence is on that, because I simply am not familiar enough with it. But I certainly, from an ethical point of view, one of the principles that would apply is that when you're going to do something, especially as a society and as a government through its laws, and that's what we're talking about here, should we continue to have a law prohibiting polygamy and making it a criminal offence, then the ethical one of the ethical principles you use is who are the most vulnerable people in this situation, and should we get, in ethics you always give priority to the most vulnerable. So you should give priority to the interests of children. And if this is bad for children, then you should do it. Also, there's another ethical principle that says that when someone can't consent, you should try to work on the basis that if they were there and they were able to decide, is it reasonably likely that they would consent to what you're doing? So, I mean, I think we need to do research on kids who come from polygamous relationships and find out what they think. Do they think that was something they would never have consented to? Why I raise this is that I'm very much involved at the moment with children born from artificial insemination, and even from adopted at birth, and their right to know their genetic identity. Who was their genetic parent? And almost unanimously they tell you, I would never have consented to not knowing this. So that's a very strong indication that ethically we should make sure that they can know that. And so I think, if you know, one thing you try to do in ethics is to be consistent in the way you approach different issues. So I would try to be consistent here in terms of how I saw same-sex marriage and applying the same principles to polygamy. And then the other issue would be, well, if you're going to have polygamy, is it discrimination not to have polyandry, which is one woman and lots of men, or several men, or however many you're going to have? And, it would be. It wouldn't be treating men and women equally. And then you come up against the problem that, well, in polygamy, the child can, even though the child shares the father with multiple other children, the child knows who its biological mother and father are. But in polyandry, unless you did some DNA testing after the kids were born, you probably wouldn't know who your genetic father is. So it's unbelievable, really. It's sort of like an unraveling ball, where we started off where... And, you know, I actually wrote 4, 5, or 6 years ago that legalizing same-sex marriage would open up the question of polygamy. And I got furious responses in the newspapers and the media and saying that was absolutely ridiculous, that same-sex marriage had nothing to do with polygamy. But really another reason why it does is that if you don't base marriage around this primary biological reality of one man, one woman can have a child, then there's no logical reason why marriage should be only two people. I mean, in a same-sex marriage, why would you limit it to two people? Because it could be more than that, who feel that they're deeply committed to each other and would spend their lives together and love each other. And if that's what marriage is about, there's no inherent reason to limit it to two. Whereas with the biological reality, that reality limits it to two.
Right. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but maybe I'll just ask you one final question, and that's, where do we go from here? Is it time to revisit same-sex marriage?
I think we probably should, but, you know, that won't be a popular recommendation. I really want to emphasize that I very much think that there's been horrible discrimination against gay people in the past, and that's absolutely got to stop. And one of the reasons, you know, why I think approving same-sex marriage, one of the benefits of it was that it does make a very strong statement that that sort of discrimination is wrong. It's just because of the same-sex marriage impact on children that I've got a problem. And so if we did revisit it, we'd have to do it in such a way that it was respectful and... also to ensure that people were not harmed to the largest extent by that revisiting. So, I mean, of course, all sorts of benefits like, you know, pension benefits, health benefits, all that stuff that came to same-sex people when they could get married, and we'd have to maintain that. I mean, I would still argue that we should, and I would certainly think we'd have to have civil unions as a recognized societal institution. That I think should be open to everyone, not just same-sex couples. So you'd have a choice of civil union or marriage, or, as is so common in Quebec, more than 50% of the young people here don't get married, they just live together. You know, these institutions, of, such as marriage, are incredibly complex, and they don't just operate for the individuals. They've got very important functions in society, and we've been in, and I think maybe we're slowly emerging from an era of what I'd call intense individualism, that when things were up to be decided, we look primarily at that individual, what they want and what we can do for them. And that's right, of course we have to do that. We failed to balance it by the needs of the community and what's good for the community and what's good for people peripheral to that immediate person, for instance, kids who are also affected by marriage. And that's what we're dealing with, not only in same-sex marriage, but we're dealing with that in polygamy. And so that is where the two actually meet, where the crossroads meet.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Somerville, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Dr. Margaret Somerville of McGill University. Well, the Blackmore trial in BC will be an interesting case to follow through the court system, as it raises some serious questions about the future of marriage in Canadian law. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners have an opinion on the topic, so be sure to leave your comments at www.lawiscool.com. That wraps up today's show for the Law is Cool podcast. My name is Devin Johnston.